Major funding for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation.
From Virginia Humanities, this is Backstory. Welcome to Backstory, the show that explains the history behind today's headlines. I'm Nathan Connolly. If you're new to the podcast, my colleagues Ed Ayers, Joanne Freeman, Brian Ballow, and myself are all historians, and each week we explore the history of one topic that's been in the news. Today on the show, we're bringing you another long-form interview, showcasing an historian's new cutting-edge scholarship.
Tonight, there is a standoff in the Great Plains. 200 Native American tribes are fighting construction.
Expected to carry crude oil from the Bakken oil field to Illinois. The roughly 1,200-mile Dakota Access Pipeline is near.
Stop! Stop!
Tonight near Cannonball, North Dakota, this is the tense face-off between an army of police and Native American protesters blocking Highway 1806, trying to shut down construction of a controversial oil pipeline on private land.
In 2016, Native people and other activists set up camp at Standing Rock, a reservation in North and South Dakota, to protest the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. These activists, known as water protectors, opposed the pipeline because they believed it violated sacred sites and threatened to contaminate the Missouri River, a major source of drinking water in the region. Taking social media by storm, the hashtag NoDapple movement grew into a protest of international proportions.
I was living in Albuquerque at the time, and we had just come back from South Dakota visiting family in early August, and we were at a memorial service for L'Oreal Sinigini, who was a 27-year-old Navajo mother who was gunned down in broad daylight by a white police officer, Austin Shipley.
That's Nick Estes. In addition to being an American Studies professor at the University of New Mexico, he's a member of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe. He's also the co-founder of Red Nation, a coalition dedicated to preserving indigenous rights.
And so we were there doing work with her family and trying to get justice on behalf of her. When we started getting, you know, reports that this camp was kind of growing and burgeoning, and we saw some of the early videos. And so we decided as an organization, the Red Nation, to send up a delegation and a head family who had set up camp there from the Kulwichasha Oyate, or the Lower Brule Sioux tribe. And so I was hearing reports from them as well. So that's really how we as an organization and myself as an individual got initially involved.
Nick's new book, Our History is the Future, details his experience at Standing Rock in 2016 while positioning that protest within the long history of indigenous resistance. He says the Dakota Access Pipeline represents a continuation, dating back centuries, of white incursion on Native land. And for Nick and many others, it's also a matter of tribal sovereignty, or the right to self-government for indigenous tribes in the United States. In this extended conversation, we talk about Nick's involvement in the 2016 protest at Standing Rock, the history of indigenous resistance, and the current state of their fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline. I started by asking him why that particular pipeline became such a flashpoint for Native people and other activists.
The Dakota Access Pipeline was transporting, or is transporting, I should say, because it is built, oil from the Bakken region in North Dakota all the way down to Illinois, which then, you know, connects and goes down to the Gulf of Mexico. Mm-hmm. But this region, specifically North Dakota, plays an important role because North Dakota was undergoing its own oil boom at the time. And it wasn't just, you know, the non-native kind of political entity of the state that was invested in the oil and gas industry. It was also the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation, where a lot of these oil rigs were concentrated.
Right.
So the oil that's going through the pipeline right now is actually, some of it is coming from the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation. Mm. And so the Fort Berthold Indian, the MHA, the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara tribe is actually financially benefiting from the Dakota Access Pipeline while kind of paradoxically opposing its construction through that part of the treaty lands, right? So, even the tribe that is benefiting from this is actually opposed to its construction because it's, you know, it's violating the treaty rights of its downstream neighbors. And so that's one of the contexts. The other context is like just the historical context. And the Missouri River, as I point out in the book, has played a central role in the conquest and settlement of that particular region because at the time of the river trade, you know, rivers were the main means of transportation. They were the highways. You know, the first European colonizers came by water, not just overseas, but also along rivers and through explorers and, you know, the fur trade. So rivers and water in that particular region have played an important role, but then also in kind of a broader kind of context of tribal and state relations within North Dakota and within South Dakota. North Dakota state government and South Dakota state government have been extremely hostile historically to tribal sovereignty, pushing and advancing the damming of the Missouri River in the 1950s and the 1960s at the expense of indigenous people. So that kind of antagonistic relationship and the geopolitics of that area exists today.
I mean, you actually make a really strong case in the book for understanding the importance of history as conceptualized by indigenous people and in thinking about the connections that are evident in their own movements, in their own communities, in the way that they frame these issues. I mean, I think it's not incidental that the title of the work, Our History is the Future, is about drawing those connections for people and not adopting, to use your description, a kind of settler colonial historical vision that simply imagines the past to be in a linear way very much behind us. What was it like being in the campsites at Standing Rock? What was the embodied look and the feel of history as folks there understood it? And how are we to, in some ways, understand this expression of activism as also being an argument about the past?
What makes a social movement, in my mind, is when you have everyday people who are showing up to the camps in their gym shorts, you know, and their t-shirts and coming as they are, right? Mm. I think that was what really crystallized it for me was to see carloads of families who, you know, quitting their jobs if they had them and just stopping their lives because this was what was important to them at that moment in time. And so I think the expression that history repeats itself is a misunderstanding of history, but I do think that there are echoes of the past and our present. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I feel like Standing Rock represented and what I saw and felt while I was there was that it was very much an echo of who we are as indigenous people in one sense, and then who we are as the Ocheti, Shakoi, the Nation of the Seven Council Fires in another, meaning that the last time, this was pointed out to me by a relative of mine. He told me the last time we united this way was in a time of war against settler encroachment in the 19th century. And now we are uniting again in a time of war under different circumstances, of course, but nonetheless to resist settler encroachment. The other thing that I felt was powerful that you really got a sense of when you were on the ground was the generational component of it. Mm-hmm. I had students that I taught high school to who were on the front lines with me in some of the marches, which was kind of a harrowing experience. It was also very bizarre because you're like, am I in a position of power in this moment? Should I be protective? Yeah. So these young people, you know, this is an experience you can't take away from them, right? And whether they're in the camp for a day, whether they're there for 9 months, you know, a weekend, a week or whatever, they, for a brief moment in time, experienced what it was like to live free. And one of the elders told me that, who was at Wounded Knee. She's like, you can't take that experience from me. You can take away my children. You can throw me in jail. But she's like, you can never take away my experience of freedom. And she specifically told me that it was thousands and thousands of young Native people who have experienced for the first time in their life what actual freedom means. And she's like, that is the biggest victory of all.
In your book, you describe an episode where you're trying to move through a shopping mall in Bismarck, North Dakota, and you are basically describing the process by which, you know, passersby and other folks who might be trying to take advantage of, you know, post-Thanksgiving Day sales actually smell the campfire scent on activists in that space and out them to local law enforcement. And there's actually a conflict that ensues, and masses of people are arrested through what is very clearly a moment of law enforcement meets basically civic policing on the part of white mallgoers. Now, it was a striking episode, and it also helped to crystallize what broader national sentiment was about a lot of your comrades' actions at the Dakota Access Pipeline. What do you think people most misunderstand about this particular moment now in American history, that the Dakota Access Pipeline protest, but also the broader efforts that this movement is a part of?
This didn't just happen at Standing Rock. And it didn't really have a beginning or an end in many ways. And what I was trying to draw out with the experience on Black Friday at the Bismarck Mall was to show that this isn't something that, you know, it was over and, you know, we lost. This is something that people have to live with, right? These are the sentiments that a lot of settler society had towards Indigenous people, specifically Lakota people and Dakota people in the region. And some of the, you know, the racial slurs that they use, I hadn't heard since I was a child or a teenager in high school. But also the idea that one can smell like an Indian is also a racialized trope, because everything we do is around campfire, whether it's ceremony. And a lot of people who go to ceremony, they end up smelling like, you know, campfire. And it wasn't just something that was unique to the Standing Rock camps, but it's something that's integral to our life and who we are. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think that, like, by and large, the broad sympathies of the mainstream were for Standing Rock, but on the ground in the everyday realities of, you know, us having to live amongst white folks who harbor, you know, violently racist attitudes towards Indigenous people, it manifests not just in the way that the police surveil and criminalize Indigenous people, but the way that those sentiments embed themselves in, you know, what I would call like an anti-Indian common sense, that it's enacted by everyday settlers, right? To quote unquote, go back to the reservation is something that's often hurled at us. And the idea behind that is that we don't belong in, you know, cities, and we don't belong in, you know, even this, the current historical moment that we're in, right? We belong in the past. So that's a common sentiment. And I think while the primary racial dynamic as it's understood in the United States is black and white, and what often gets, you know, dissolved into that racial binary is Indigenous people.
Thinking about your particular intervention, not just at the site as an activist, but particularly as an author and as a historian, I'm curious about how your experience at Standing Rock influenced your approach to writing your book. Why did you choose to interweave your personal story with your scholarship?
It wasn't my idea to put myself in the story. I was having trouble articulating elements of the experience in the camps themselves. And my editor, and I was just sitting and I was talking to my editor, Audrea Lim, about this. And I was like, yeah, I just don't know how to, I don't know how to describe this. The safety of being a historian, right, is that you can, oh, it's in the past. You know, you have somewhat of a distance from it, and you assume this false objectivity. Even though we have all these theories about objectivity is false, we still like pretend like we're being objective. And, you know, I was just having trouble with it. And she's like, well, just describe it from your own family history. And she's like, what you've told me and what you've described, she's like, people want to hear that. And I was like, do people really want to hear about me? You know, and I was like, I don't want to center myself. And she's like, nobody cares about you. They just want to live the history through your story. And I was like, okay, well, that makes me feel a little bit better. So I felt like that was the route that I was going to take with telling that particular story, because, you know, on one hand, it isn't about me, because there are thousands of people with similar stories to mine, right? And so I'm one among many. And another way to think about it is that I was trained as a journalist. And so as a journalist, you try to live out what you're seeing on the page, right? And it's not about you as an individual. It's about you're relaying through your senses, whether it's smell, sight, sound, what is happening and what is taking place. And so in that sense, that's what I tried to do with that particular centering of myself. Right. But also, you know, my own family history, my grandfathers were historians, and I feel like that's a legacy that I should be proud about, not just as an individual, but as from our own community and our own family. Mm. You know, indigenousness is fundamentally a way of relating, right? Whether it's through knowledge, whether it's through how we communicate and tell stories, we're always thinking about relations. That's one thing I would say that Dakota and Lakota people are obsessed with, right? How do we be good relatives? How are we in relation to all of these things? And I think I am trying to make relations with my ancestors, right? And giving them full credit and citing them, but also positioning myself within that tradition.
You'll hear more of my conversation with Nick Estes, but first, a word from our sponsor. Have you ever wondered what it'd be like to be David Bowie's neighbor? Or to get into a water gun fight with Tupac? From Audio Boom and Muddy Knees Media, A Life Lived reveals how the lives of the biggest stars were truly lived, with exclusive interviews from the people who knew them in life. Journalist Stephanie Okupniak tells the stories of the dead. A Life Lived is a tribute to the icons who changed countless lives and continue to do so, even in death. Each Monday, Stephanie will tell the tale of another deceased celebrity through interviews with relatives and friends of the deceased, sharing their personal stories. On A Life Lived, you'll hear about the lives lived by Amy Winehouse, Muhammad Ali, Carrie Fisher, and many more. Tune in and find out Stan Lee's relationship advice, the Queen of Soul's favorite food, and which hardcore rocker fought Kurt Cobain. This Audio Boom original is an unmissable listen. A Life Lived is out now and has new episodes every Monday. Be sure to search for and subscribe to A Life Lived on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. In Nick's book, he talks about his personal experience at Standing Rock and connects it to the bigger history of Indigenous resistance. In this part of the conversation, we unpack that history. Now, you write that the history of the United States is the history of settler colonialism. What do you mean by that?
Settler colonialism is a specific form of colonialism that defines this country, meaning that it destroys to replace. Evasion isn't, you know, just a one-time event. It's a structure. It's ongoing. But I think what I tried to do in my book is to understand settler colonialism is not just about the elimination of indigenous people for the taking of lands, but also about eliminating our relationship to that land and eliminating our relationship to the non-human world. And so I look at treaties and how treaties included, you know, things such as buffalo and our right to have buffalo and how buffalo defined our territory. And so I think settler colonialism, you know, was about annihilating the buffalo to gain access to territory, as I point out in Article 11 of the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty.
When you think about the longer history of U.S. and First Nations interactions, I mean, the early contacts were not as clearly articulated, or at least not as clearly framed as being one of extraction. I mean, thinking specifically of the Lewis and Clark expedition, I mean, what were those early encounters like?
The Lewis and Clark expedition was very much a military expedition into a territory that the United States was trying to claim as its own. And so it was very much an imperialist endeavor. And so Lewis and Clark, what they were trying to do is to begin the process of shifting the sphere of influence away from Britain and France, who had traders in the region, and towards the United States, right? To begin kind of that colonization process. And it wasn't initially extractive, but it was, you know, it was to essentially take over the fur trade industry and to Americanize it, so to speak, and to bring in Native nations into dependent relations with the United States.
So some of the early changes for Sioux people and their environment looked like what?
The first dramatic change specific to European colonization was the decimation of fur-bearing animals and the beginning of the commodification of life for profit. Even if you read Lewis and Clark's journals, the fur trade was well underway by the time they went up the river. And Europeans weren't an anomaly in the region, right? So in their journals, they describe basically being able to take a scattershot or like, you know, what we'd understand as like birdshot today and just shoot it in the air and hit a pigeon because there was so much bounty and so much life on the land, right? And there's so many animals that they encountered that are completely extinct to that river environment. And not only were the life worlds of indigenous peoples being annihilated through disease and private military expeditions of these fur trade groups, but the animal world was being decimated as well because of the fur trade. And so I think that was the first ecological change that we experienced alongside of, you know, disease and the beginning of violence against indigenous women and non-men as a way to subordinate the political order of indigenous nations that were seen as threatening to the European fur trade industry.
Right. And that kind of violence, the domestic kind, the kind directed toward the environment, that was effectively a precursor to what I guess folks would call the Indian Wars of the 19th century, particularly between the U.S. and the Sioux. I mean, how would you describe how those conflicts emerged and were sustained? And what do they tell us about the effectiveness of the treaties that run through the 19th century period?
Well, the initial conflicts, like the major wars, were essentially about evicting these American fur traders who had enacted forms of violence against indigenous women, but then also to exert control over that fur trade economy. And later on, of course, these conflicts evolved into more sustained military campaigns because settlers were moving west. In colonizing land, and you know, in Utah, for example, we had the Mormon Trail as well as the Bozeman Trail that went into Montana, and they were trespassing through indigenous territory, Lakota territory, and prime buffalo hunting grounds, and they were disturbing the migration patterns of buffalo at that time. So, if we can boil a lot of this down, these first conflagrations with the United States, it boils down to food. If we look at the 1862 U.S. Dakota War, those young scouts who stole eggs because they were starving from a white farming family who they subsequently massacred, that was over hunger because there was imposed starvation conditions on the reservation, and the failure to live up to treaty obligations because of the, you know, the justification was because of the Civil War that was happening in the East. And so that initial conflict arose over the question of food because Dakota people were starving to death. And the other wars that happened, you know, the war for the Black Hills was also around the right to continue to hunt buffalo. And so Crazy Horse, Sitting Bull, you know, maintained the belief and the affirmation that indigenous people and Lakota people in general must maintain and protect their relationship to the Buffalo Nations. And a way to defeat us, a way that we were defeated, wasn't through outright military conquest of them bringing their soldiers in kind of a traditional militarized manner and just conquering us. It was about annihilating our food source. And so they began the Buffalo Genocide.
And thinking about that question of sustainability and, you know, building and sustaining communities, where does the Missouri River fit in? I mean, how central is it to Sioux culture and the way of life? And why does that continue to become a place where a lot of these conflicts will emerge, not just in the 19th century, but then deep into the 20th century as well?
With U.S. invasion, the river was seen as a source of violence because of the fur trade. And so certain nations and tribes and bands had developed a different relationship where some of them developed a policy of avoidance, of avoiding the river itself. And then with the reservation period following the end of the Sioux Wars and the implementation of reservation systems, the river bottomlands became choice lands for hunting, for fishing, and for, you know, subsistence agriculture. So moving into the reservation period, a lot of nations began moving closer and closer to the river just because it was easier. It was just a lush river environment, right? So our tribe, for example, the Lower Brule Sioux tribe, had always kind of maintained its connection to the Missouri River.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas parts of Standing Rock, you know, there was more of an ebb and flow with the seasons, whereas we were kind of more sedentary. We would just kind of stay on along the river itself. We were a little bit more agricultural, and the same with the Yankton. They had large, you know, cornfields and squash fields. They had a mixed kind of agricultural hunting, gathering economy. And so in the reservation period, there was just kind of a restart of that sedentary life along the river bottomlands. So the river in the 20th century was again a means for life. And then, of course, in the mid-20th century, when they began damming the river, it also became a means for death.
Well, this is the Pick-Sloan plan, right?
Right.
And it actually has an extraordinary effect on not just the folks who are living there, but in trying to basically galvanize an American Indian movement. I mean, tell me about that relationship.
So at the start of World War II, there was a movement to develop the river, essentially to provide post-war employment. And they looked to the successes of the Fort Peck Dam that was built in, you know, the late 1930s, which employed 10,000 workers and provided labor and relief to primarily white workers at the expense of the Fort Peck Indian Reservation. And so the Pick-Sloan Plan basically picked up the momentum from these states commissions to build a 5-dam system on the Missouri River, which at the time was the largest dam system in the world. And
Wow. It
was characterized on all fronts, except for indigenous peoples themselves, as a modern kind of success story of a technological innovation and damming of the river. John F. Kennedy himself talked about this river, the hydroelectricity would bring light to a dark place, using kind of these civilizational tropes. I later found out that my grandmother and my grandfather were at that talk, and I can't imagine what it was like to hear somebody celebrating or extolling the virtues of damming and destroying your homelands. Because the other side of it is that almost 1 out of 3 Native people who lived along the river had to be removed. So you have about 30% of the population on the reservations removed to make way for these dams. You have the destruction, and these are the government statistics. These aren't what our tribes estimated in damages, but the government estimated that the dams destroyed 75% of wildlife, which included plant life, wild plants, as well as animals, and destroyed 90% of commercial timber on the reservations. And in places like the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation, which I talked about earlier, 90% of the agricultural lands had been destroyed.
Thinking about the founding of the United Nations in the late 1940s, there is a rich history of people seeking international recognition, whether it's, you know, We Charge Genocide in 1951 with William Patterson and that movement, or thinking about Malcolm X arguing for a plebiscite before the UN in the mid-60s. You detail the fact that the effort to seek international recognition begins at Standing Rock in 1974. What is that story?
The International Indian Treaty Council, which formed at Standing Rock in 1974, wasn't the first indigenous international organization. Mm-hmm. The National Indian Brotherhood, which, you know, was based in Canada, had made headway years prior to that. There were other instances. You know, Haudenosaunee Confederacy attempted to get recognition at the League of Nations. So it wasn't a unique thing in that sense, but it represented a different kind of thing. And it was specifically had a Lakota and Dakota element to it because it centered our treaty, our 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty, which they felt was going to be the tip of the spear for the international indigenous movement. And so what they did is they sent out activists throughout the world to essentially get third world nations and movements to recognize our treaty claim and our international relationship with the United States. And so if the U.S. wasn't going to live up to its treaty obligations, then we would pressure them in the world court. You know, I detail the court case that happened in Lincoln, Nebraska, known as the treaty hearings, you know, where our treaty was basically put on trial and Judge Erbom said that we weren't an independent sovereign nation that was immune from U.S. laws, but that treaties themselves were proof of an international relationship, which kind of seems contradictory, but nonetheless...
Just a bit, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's the history of Indian law, right? But nonetheless, that was the impetus for the movement to go to the United Nations. And had they not gone to the United Nations with this intense state repression and infiltration, but then also just the kind of media blackout around the international movement, I don't think that the movement would have sustained itself from that generation to this generation.
I wanted to close my conversation with Nick Estes by taking it back to where it all began. And so I asked him for an update on the status of the Dakota Access Pipeline and how it's changed the nature of indigenous resistance.
As of last week, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe has filed a motion in federal court to block the expansion of the Dakota Access Pipeline. So they're trying to expand its capacity. So I don't know if it's, I think it's, they're actually going to try to double its capacity, meaning that they're going to try to push more oil through it at a higher rate. And right now it's a long-term battle. It's something that I think is connected to the Keystone XL struggle, which we thought had been won under Obama. But, you know, since then Trump has revived it. But I think electoral politics aren't the measure of success of a movement. And right now, you know, we just had the Native American Presidential Forum and a lot of the chairmen and chair people from the Northern Plains who are now facing down the construction of Keystone XL pipeline through our treaty lands are getting ready because Trump has set the stage. Trump's administration, as well as the state of South Dakota, has set the stage for this pipeline to be built in 2020 in the midst of the, you know, the next presidential election. And I think it tells you something that the Dakota Access Pipeline was built at the same time, you know, that we had this historic presidential election going on, right? So I think in one sense, we as Lakota and Dakota people are really tired of being thrown into what we consider, many of us consider settler infighting. Because Obama couldn't stop this pipeline. Trump just accelerated it, you know, and so it gets really frustrating. I mean, I have my own political orientation towards it, but I think by and large, I think there's just a general feeling of a frustration. But then facing that situation alongside of the enforced poverty of reservation life and the continued and amplified discrimination against Indigenous people as a fallout to the Dakota Access Pipeline. So it's really unfortunate. I think people are ready for this fight. It's just that we have to understand that these places, these counties where this pipeline is proposing to go through are some of the poorest counties in the country and some of the poorest places in North America. And we are some of the poorest people in North America. And we need broader attention and support on these issues in that we don't want to fight our treaty rights on the ground with the police, right? We want our treaty rights to be respected by the broad swath of American society because treaty rights are everyone's rights. And I think that's where we're at right now. And we're also, you know, in a more positive note, we are in a better position locally with the kind of white settler population in the Northern Plains than we were in 2011 because they are experiencing the opioid epidemic, right? They're experiencing rural flight, economic abandonment. And so they are understanding that they're in the same boat with us and that they drink the same water as us, they breathe the same air as us, and they're looking for an alternative. And some of them are actually turning to indigenous sovereignty.
Nick Estes is an assistant professor of American Studies at the University of New Mexico. He's also a citizen of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe. His new book is called Our History is the Future,
Standing Rock versus the Dakota Access Pipeline and the long tradition of indigenous resistance. That's going to do it for us today, but you can keep the conversation going online. Let us know what you thought of the episode or ask us your questions about history. You'll find us at backstoryradio.org or send an email to backstory@virginia.edu. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Backstory Radio. Whatever you do, don't be a stranger. Backstory is produced at Virginia Humanities. Major support is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, the Johns Hopkins University, and the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations. Additional support is provided by the Tomato Fund, cultivating fresh ideas in the arts, the humanities, and the environment.
Brian Ballow is Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Ed Ayers is Professor of the Humanities and President Emeritus of the University of Richmond. Joanne Freeman is Professor of History and American Studies at Yale University. Nathan Connolly is the Herbert Baxter Adams Associate Professor of History at the Johns Hopkins University. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for Virginia Humanities.